from 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. Welcome to the Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.
Hello and welcome to the Art of the Matter. I'm Travis DiNicola. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Baselli Walrab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
And I'm Sharon Gamble. Today I'll find out about the Women Writing for a Change program.
I'll get a preview of the first Indianapolis Jewish Film Festival.
And I'll learn about a unique partnership between the Alzheimer's Association and the Indianapolis Museum of Art. And we'll have that arts calendar we call
What'll We Do? All that and more right after the latest news from NPR. Women Writing for a Change offers programs for women and girls using writing as a tool for self-expression. The organization was founded by Mary Pierce Brosnan in 1991 in Cincinnati, with chapters around the country now. The Indianapolis chapter began in 2006 and has offered classes, workshops, retreats, public read-alouds, and more. Spring programs begin soon, and Sharon Gamble invited Deb Bueller to our studios to learn more.
So how did you get involved with Women Writing for a Change? How did you first hear about this program?
Well, it's interesting. I have a friend who is involved in lots of women's things in the city. And so she mentioned, you might like this Women Writing for a Change. And that was in 2008. And I first went to Cincinnati for a weekend retreat before joining the Indianapolis Circle.
And that's where it was founded originally,
yes,
right? Back in 91, I think?
Yes, and founded by Mary Pierce Brosmer.
Mm-hmm.
And but the Indianapolis school is owned by Mindy Weaver Flask. And so after I went to the Moy, which is a monastery, and did a weekend retreat, I came back and met Mindy and said, I want to be involved in the Indianapolis Circle, and started writing there. So
big picture thoughts here. Why do women need their own group or place to write?
Well, the mission of Women Writing for a Change is to nurture and celebrate individual voices. And I think that, and we could look historically at how women changed their name to men's names, women writers, and so from that kind of perspective. But the Women Writing for a Change itself holds holds feminist values like hospitality and creativity, and all of those things blend together to do that nurturing of women's voices. And I think even in our culture today, where we see few women writers in some publications, there's an opportunity for us as women to collaborate and lift up that writing voice in all its forms, poetry, memoir, fiction, all those things.
You said kind of a key word back there, which is nurturing. This is a very supportive environment cultivated by Women Writing for a Change, right?
Right, it is. So we have practices, as I mentioned, that are feminist practices of hospitality, of respect for each other, of confidentiality. Not every writer is there to, share a personal story. Some writers come because they are working on a piece of fiction, while others come in and are using writing as a transformative tool to reflect on their own story. And so it's a safe place, a safe container, we say, where we can collaborate together and listen, hold confidentiality, share stories, and also get feedback about our writing in very respectful ways.
You know, we do live in a culture where the first question people ask each other at a party, a social gathering of any kind, is, what do you do? So I wonder, though, if maybe some of the people who come to these sessions aren't writing to be published, aren't writing, you know, sometimes their writing maybe isn't meant to see the light of day. Maybe it's just for themselves. Am I on track there?
Yes. So some people are coming and, you know, want to take their journaling to another level or use writing as part of their spiritual practice. So it's more about that showing up at the page on a daily basis and using it as a meditative practice, or and sometimes it's very playful. It's poetry. It's something fun. It's then maybe it is getting their own story on the page, as in grief, which is how I used Women Writing for a Change. That story, those stories of the losses that I've had, keep coming back to the page for me, and so there is that following your muse element of Women Writing for a Change, where your own writing takes you further and further into exploring what it is to lose your parent, as in my case. So,
was there a moment in which you said, during working through the grief of one or the other of your parents or other losses in your life, was there a moment where the light bulb came on and you said, I need to write about this. That's my process.
There is, I've co-authored a book at the beginning, kind of what seems now the beginning of my grief process. The book is called The Hollowed Heart, and it's a book for women awakening from grief and loss. And I collaborated on that with Louise Dunn. And we, in our conversations about grief and loss, realized that, again, women sometimes are so busy in their lives that mourning their loss is sometimes lost because we are caregiving for the remaining parent or for other children or for, all the other things that women do.
Sure.
So I wrote about it first and then ended up doing more and more training in grief and seeing that connection to my writing life grow and deepen.
How did you become a writer in the first place? Because you've been a writer since long before Women Writing for a Change got founded.
Right. I think I always wanted to be a writer, but I grew up in that generation of women who I was told you can be a school teacher or a nurse.
What did they – the pink collar ghetto, I think, was the phrase that was floated around that time.
Right. Yeah. And I was kind of discouraged from writing, but then I moved into work in the education field, and specifically at the Indianapolis Zoo. I wrote the visitor graphics, and then I wrote grants, and then from there started writing other business-oriented things. And so that kind of took me closer and closer to writing now as an independent writer. So,
was there ever a point where you felt, hey, it's okay that I'm a woman and I'm a writer now? You kind of came into it from sneaky little angles, visitor information. That's really more like marketing, grant writing. Well, that's fundraising. That's,
Exactly. And I think it took me a long time to sort of claim that I'm a writer. And as a result of being a participant in Women Writing for a Change, being in that circle, that's where I gained my confidence to say, hi, I'm Deb Bueller and I'm a writer. And, claim that as part of who I am and the work I do.
Writing is interesting because everybody theoretically has the skills to be a writer, pretty much everybody, because it's such a core part. You can't really get through most schooling without having some capacity for writing.
Mm-hmm.
But going that extra step and tapping into the creativity or the reasoning sense or the mystery or whatever it is you need to draw on for your own writing, that is not as easy to do.
It's uncomfortable.
Why do you think that is?
Well, I think first that we also have an internal critic, and our critic is sitting there saying, you're going to write that or or some other judging thing. And sometimes that critic is also a perfectionist. So it keeps us in that place where we're not willing to experiment and be in the mystery and be messy and see terrible first drafts and let that be what it is as part of the process. So, yeah, I think we are critics sometimes. It's hard to kick the critic out the door.
You go in the corner, time out.
That's it.
Tell us about some of the workshops and classes coming up this spring.
Well, so I've been invited by Mindy Weaver Flask to teach a short semester of Women Writing for a Change myself to facilitate a daytime circle. And so that will begin on Tuesday, April 8th at the Benton House and run for 6 weeks. And the fee for that is $175. So, and then I'm also teaching a journaling class at IUPUI in June, three Thursday evenings in June, the 5th, 12th, and 19th. And people can see that in the IUPUI Continuing Education brochure. And then I'm going to be doing remembering journals, and those are actually writing, a blend of writing and art making. So we're actually creating a journal, a book, where we'll blend things like paints and sympathy cards or photographs or any kinds of things that people want to bring to the class to make into their journal. And you know, and that journal could be a place for holding poetry. It could be a place for holding those commemorative things about someone or something. And we'll be doing those once a month at Inspire in Broad Ripple.
Now, the daytime circle, how does that get shaped? Does each person just come and say, right now I'm at a stage of my life where I want to work on my poetry. May I bring that to the class? And somebody else might bring a memoir. Is that kind of how the shape?
Yes. Yeah. So the women who come to that class are welcome to come with something they'd like to work on. And some women come in with no writing experience, but a desire or even a sense of urge to get their story on the page. And then we'll use some very intentional practices in a large circle and in small groups and sometimes in pairs, where we'll share our writing with each other and then hold that space where we're not being judgmental of the writing. We presume goodwill among each other as we listen and share both. And that creates its own sort of momentum and energy for the group and for each individual in the room.
You know, some of our listeners may have said, "Deb Buehler, I think I've seen her byline." So they've probably read you in Indianapolis Star, among other places. If you're writing for a publication, web publication, print publication, broadcast, there's usually some kind of a deadline. And so that helps you shed some of your perfectionism.
It does.
But It strikes me that these writing circles could be used in the same way. Oh my gosh, it's tomorrow! It's tomorrow at lunchtime. I need to get back to my keyboard and finish this. Do you find that happening?
Yes, that's true. It does build in a sense of accountability because you're coming back to the circle every week, and you want to use that time intentionally. And so, you want to bring back, everyone wants to bring back something that they've, you know, mulled over, played with, mused with during the week between classes. So, yes, it does build in a sense of accountability to yourself and to your group.
So some people sharpen all the pencils in their house as a way to kind of get ready to write. Do you have a ritual for yourself for writing?
Oh, that's a great question. So I have several favorite spaces that I like to write in my home, and it is about bringing the pen, a pen that's fluid and not sticky or splotchy when I write with it. I'm picky about what I write with. And then I have different notebooks that I like to write in, the kind that fold back so I can really hold them in my lap. Sometimes I use a lap board if I'm writing in a chair in my bedroom. So, and I know other writers also light a candle, and sometimes I do that to designate the beginning and the end of my writing time. You know, creating that sense of space around. I've hung up my sign, my do not disturb sign in my home before, and said, okay, I'm going to write for a while for myself. And yeah.
Do you ever reach the end of a, let's say you've designated 2 hours for yourself before you're going to go get dinner ready or whatever? Do you ever reach the end and go, I can't stop now?
Sure. Just get lost in the timing of it. And, you know, the piece doesn't feel done, or I don't feel done getting it all out. I want that story on the page.
Sharon Gamble with Women Writing for a Change mentor Deb Buehler. Learn more about the organization at IndieWomenWriting.com. Again, IndieWomenWriting.com. And you can learn more about Deb Buehler at TheSweetestWords.com. Again, TheSweetestWords.com.
You're listening to The Art of the Matter on WFYI 90.1 FM Public Radio.
From Hasidic Jews confronting their homosexuality to four overweight Israeli men who discover sumo wrestling, nine Jewish movies will be featured in the premier Indianapolis Jewish Film Festival from May 3rd through May 10th. Travis DiNicola spoke with the festival's founder, Bob Epstein.
Bob, welcome to Art of the Matter. Thanks for coming here today.
It is my pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.
Absolutely. So this is a pretty interesting lineup of films that that you have for this the first Indianapolis Jewish Film Festival. And I want to get to that lineup in just a moment. But let's start with, how did this come about? How did you get involved? And what was the impetus for having a Jewish film festival here?
Well, about 3 years ago, several of us started a new temple in Carmel called Congregation Beth Shalom, and we were looking for some projects to do that were cultural in nature. I looked around, and having been a film buff for many, many years, I saw that Indianapolis never had a Jewish film festival.
Mm-hmm.
There are 60 of them around the country, one actually in South Bend.
Really?
Big ones in New York City, Boston, San Francisco, L.A., and as an example, Charlotte, which is a city not unlike Indianapolis in size, is on their 11th film festival. So I thought this would be a good project, and I pulled together a committee of people, including some people that were not in our congregation, but as consultants, Dennis Neary, who was a film producer, and David Shank, who was a public relations gentleman. And we've had many, many meetings. We probably had three or four meetings just to select films. We did that in my house. I had five screening rooms set up and broke up maybe 20 people into different rooms to look at 30 or 40 films, and from that we selected the ones that you have before you.
So what sort of criteria did you have for this? Were these did the film have to be to be made in Israel? Did it have to have specific Jewish themes? How did you sort of pick and choose that?
Generally, they had to have some Jewish theme. They did not have to be Israeli. There are two or three, I think, that are made in Israel. Some of them are set in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
The first one, David, takes place in Brooklyn.
Okay.
It's the story of an Arab boy, Daoud, which is Arabic for David, who sees a book left by an Orthodox Jewish boy on a park bench, and he takes it to the school where the Jewish kids go to school, called the yeshiva, and puts the book into a mailbox. And when he goes home, he realizes he's left his a family Quran in the box instead of the siddur. So he goes back and goes into the yeshiva, the school. Lo and behold, the rabbi comes out, and he said, what are you doing? And he said, well, I'm trying to return a book, and I'm actually looking for one. And the rabbi says, what's your name? And he says, Daoud. Rabbi says, I didn't understand you. So he says, David. Well, David, come into Hebrew class. So he, David goes into the Hebrew class, and that's the beginning of the story, with all the tensions that you might imagine as the result of an Arab boy being in a Hebrew class.
Sure, sure. And these are all contemporary films as well, right? Or for the most part?
For the most part, in the last few years, we were thinking about a very good Holocaust film called The Voyage of the Damned, which is about 30 years old, and decided for the first year we were not going to do a Holocaust film. Our focus was on films that are international in scope and have a very positive point to them, by and large. The Other Son, as an example, is an Israeli film which consists of two boys, one Palestinian and one Israeli, that are switched at birth. So the Israeli family raises the Palestinian boy and vice versa. They find out when they go to the hospital where the children were born that there's a mistake. And so now we've got a dramatic interplay of the two families to resolve that issue. Again, very, very positive, though.
Tell me about one film I'm very curious about that involves sumo wrestling.
Yes, Matter of Size.
Yeah,
Matter
great
of
title.
Size is, well, you wouldn't qualify, Travis. You're not heavy enough.
Bob, I appreciate you saying that.
Right, but maybe we're all a little overweight. But anyway, Matter of Size is the story of four grossly overweight Israeli men that are down on themselves because of their weight. One of them works in Israel for a Japanese sushi restaurant.
Okay.
And the owner of the restaurant pulls him aside, and he says, you know, I know you're down because of your weight, whatever. He said, in Japan, we have sumo wrestlers that are all very heavy, and they're very well respected. So the long and the short of it is this owner is a sumo coach.
Okay.
And he puts together an Israeli sumo wrestling team. And that's the story. It's a comedy. It's quite funny.
It sounds funny. It sounds great. Almost a little bit like the Jamaican bobsled team, but interesting. Okay, so another film on the list I know has gotten quite a lot of attention, and it's Trembling Before G-D.
God.
Yes.
Trembling Before God. Trembling mm-hmm. Before God is a story and a movie. It's a documentary that has gotten a lot of attention all around the world. It's the story of gays among ultra-Orthodox Jews. And that film will be shown at Christian Theological Seminary, I believe, on May the 10th
mm-hmm.
at
Saturday,
noon,
May 10th.
At mm-hmm. noon. And we intend to have a panel discussion before the film, which I, for better of any other term, call gays and religion.
Mm-hmm.
And so we'll have most of the major faiths represented to discuss how each religion deals with gays among them, among their midst.
Let's talk about the locations of where the films are, because I mean, some of these are at the Landmark Theater, but you just mentioned Trembling Before God is a Christian Theological. You also have films at University High School, Light of the World Christian Church, the Central Library. None of the films are being showed at a temple.
That's correct. Well, that's not exactly correct, because mm-hmm. Congregation Beth Shalom actually meets mm-hmm. at University High School. So
that's
our home base. We don't have a building of our own.
Okay.
We want this to be a community event, so mm-hmm. we didn't want to just show it at a the Academy or the JCC. We wanted mm-hmm. it to be shown around. So that's why we thought the Central Public Library, which is a wonderful auditorium, would be a good place to start.
Sure.
We're starting off with David sort of as a dry run because we don't know how it's going to go exactly. And then on May 4th, the second night, we're showing The Band's Visit, which is a real hoot. And
this is, again, at the Central Library May 4th.
It is, at the Central Public Library. Mm-hmm. That will feature a film of an Egyptian military band going to Israel to play at the Arab Cultural Center.
Mm-hmm.
And when they take the wrong bus, and they end up in a Negev village, and the band leader goes up to a very attractive Israeli lady and says, where is the Arab Cultural Center? And she says, there is no Arab Cultural Center here. In fact, there's no Israeli Cultural Center. There's no culture of any time. And by the way, you're stranded for 2 days. Well, the long and the short of it is they get along great. There's interaction between the different people, and it's a very positive film. And that'll be our gala. We'll be featuring a belly dancer, an Egyptian belly dancer, an Egyptian band, and we'll be serving Middle Eastern food.
Excellent, excellent. So that's definitely a fairly special night. People can get information at IndianapolisJewishFilmFestival.com about getting tickets for that evening?
Yes. Mm-hmm. That's certainly one of the ways that they can do it. The actual website is www.IndianapolisJewishFilmFestival.com. If you just Google Indianapolis Jewish Film Festival, you'll find it, and there's a way to order tickets right on the website.
And then for the other movies, now I know the one 6 Days in June at University High School is a free screening. That's a special invitation you're doing for University High School. But the other films, $10 generally is what it is?
$10 for each except for the gala, which is $30.
Mm-hmm.
The one at University High School we think will sell out. We may have to do a second showing of that same night. And Dr. Pierre Atlas, who is a Middle Eastern scholar, will be speaking before the film. By the way, it is a PBS film, which is a very balanced film regarding the Six-Day War in 1967 involving Israel and Egypt.
This is quite a great undertaking. You've got some fantastic films that you're going to be screening here in Indianapolis. But I do think it's important to also recognize, I mean, just the history of Jews who have been involved with the movie industry over the years, whether it's actors, producers, directors, writers. I mean, that's a significant contribution to the cinema.
I would have to agree with you. In all respects, the general community may not be quite aware of the people that have been involved in the formation of the film industry in this country, going back to Samuel Goldwyn, mm-hmm. Jack Warner. Today you've got Steven Spielberg, Woody Allen. You've got Burt Lancaster, Tony Curtis, and on and on and on. Directors, of course. So,
Jews. The Coen brothers, the Weinstein brothers. I mean,
oh,
yeah,
yes.
Yeah, of
and
course.
The Coen brothers, I believe, as well. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure about that, mm-hmm. but I know Weinstein for sure.
Mm-hmm.
So there's been a major contribution to the movie industry in this country. And I think what a lot of Americans don't realize, there is a very significant Israeli film industry,
mm-hmm.
Which we have, we will be showing at least a couple of their films. Time of Favor is one of them, and Live and Become are Israeli films. I think there may be three or four, actually. The Other Son is an Israeli film as well.
Very good. So Bob, I need to ask, have you always been a film buff yourself? I mean, you said that, you know, you had got involved with this congregation and were sort of looking for a way to, you know, connect to in a cultural way to the community.
I have been a film buff for a long time. I screen a lot of movies.
Mm-hmm.
My sister lived in L.A. for 50 years and was a member of the Hollywood Film Society. Used to see 8 to 10 films a week.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, I speak to her every day, and she'll say, did you see this? Did you see that? And,
oh,
and she has been a consultant to me on which films maybe should be selected.
Okay.
She was actually the person that I think was most influential in selecting The Band's Visit.
Mm-hmm.
We were looking at two or three other films, one of them being The Chosen, which is not a new film. It's been around for a while, and one of the stars is Robbie Benson, who is now in Bloomington.
Yeah.
And I spoke to Robbie about coming up, and unfortunately he has a heart condition.
Hmm.
But her advice was, for a gala, a really fun film that everyone's going to enjoy.
Sure.
She had seen all of our films, and she said, I like The Band's Visit. So when I recommended that to our committee, they all agreed.
Excellent. Well, I wish you the best of luck with this. It sounds like it's going to be a great film festival. We've got a great lineup, and congratulations on your first year.
Well, thank you so much.
Travis DiNicola with Bob Epstein, founder of the Indianapolis Jewish Film Festival, which takes place from May 3rd through May 10th. Get more information at IndianapolisJewishFilmFestival.com, IndianapolisJewishFilmFestival.com. Hey, Travis.
Yes, Sharon.
You've got the right kind of curly hair to do this impersonation. Could you do it for me? Oh, that's such an adorable little fluffy lamb.
Oh, thank you.
That's because March may have entered like a lion, but we're just determined to make sure we're gonna kick it out like a lamb.
Absolutely.
No offense to tiny little sheep.
To little
Sorry.
Lambs. You don't want to kick a lamb.
No,
but,
no lamb kicking. I take it back. Don't write to us at artofthematter@wfyi.org. It's just an expression.
But there are more than one way to skin a lamb or shear a sheep or do something with a cat. Anyway, and we'll talk about all of them on that calendar we call.
What'll we do?
Here we go.
Oh, my.
Yes. Well, speaking of deadly games, that is what's being presented by the Candlelight Theater at the Harrison Presidential Mansion. And this is pretty cool. Games are fun, of course. And so sometimes they have consequences. And that's what Deadly Games is all about. Three games have taken a fatal turn. And all three plays are going to be performed in three different rooms at the Harrison Mansion as candlelight, historical artifacts, and that great setting there ensconce you in all the diabolical action. And it features three different plays, as I said. The Suicide Club, which is actually based on a story by Robert Louis Stevenson, as well as Blind Woman's Bluff and Games We Played. They start with performances in April 11th and 12th, as well as the 25th and 27th, May 2nd and 3rd, Friday and Saturdays at 8, also Sunday matinees at 2. And you do need to make reservations. You can go online to bhpsite.org and get more information. But it sounds pretty fun. Three plays, deadly games at the Harrison home.
Wow, scary. Hey, so we were making references to shearing sheep. Yes, we do have a sound effects library, but that's not nearly as fun as doing it ourselves. You might find handmade items made out of locally sourced wool at the Indiana. Don't worry, they don't hurt the critters. They just shear them and then they spin the wool. They're not hurting them.
Right.
But you might find handcrafted wool items at the Indiana Artisan Marketplace at the State Fairgrounds this weekend on Saturday and Sunday. Remember, Indiana Artisan Network comprises some of the finest craftspeople. It's a juried group, some of the finest craftspeople in artisanal food and beverage, as well as visual arts and fine crafts. So
it's a great event.
Oh, it's a wonderful event. Lots of food samples, so you can find out more about that or just go.
Food and fun.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, it's not too early to start planning for this year's UIndy. That's right, University of Indianapolis' Jazz Week, because that starts on Monday, April 7th, goes through Saturday the 12th. And includes the UIndy Jazz Combo and also Jazz Ensemble. And Sophie Fott, you heard me talk to her last week. In fact, she and her band are doing a concert on Wednesday the 9th based on the paintings of Stephen Sickles. And then you've got the Jamie Arbuthnot Quartet on the 10th, saxophonist George Garzone on the 11th, and the Steve Ali Big Band wrapping up the week on the 12th. Some are free, some are you need tickets for. You can get all sorts of information at uindy.edu and find out about all the things going on at the UIndy Jazz Week.
Speaking of festivals on university campuses, you have just a few days to get your schedule organized for the second Butler Arts Fest, which has the crazy and wonderful theme of fables, fairy tales, and physics. Lots and lots of amazing things going on out there, including the first science fiction opera written by Franz Josef Haydn and performed in the observatory. Limited seating for that one. Go to butler.edu and search for art. Or actually, you can go to butlerartsfest.com and find everything. Or you can go to the university website and find stuff as well.
Well, you know, Sharon, they say that when it comes to love, anything goes.
Okay.
Even at sea, which is why the Cole Porter Classic has that great song and music, Anything Goes, and in that it's opening up April 3rd at Beef and Board Dinner Theater, and it's part of their 80th anniversary celebration. Maybe I should say it tap dances into Beef and Board's, it's just a fun show featuring some great songs like It's Still Lovely, I Get a Kick Out of You, You're the Top, and of course, Anything Goes. So that will be taking place at Beef and Board's through May 11th.
Travis.
Sharon.
All hail Fredonia.
Oh.
Hooray for Captain Spaulding.
Yes.
Duck Soup, the four Marx Brothers and Margaret Dumont classic.
Love
Duck Soup. And you know what? We've all gotten in the habit of streaming things through our computer, streaming movies through the computer, or watching them on DVD in the privacy of our living rooms. There is nothing more fun than seeing a classic comedy like Duck Soup from 1933 on a big screen with a bunch of other people. And you can do that this Saturday night at 7 o'clock.
Other ducks? No, other lambs. Never mind. People, you said people.
People, right. Yeah. At the Garfield Park Arts Center, it's a hoot. And if you've never seen it on the big screen, do yourself a favor. And there's a bonus, a reel of trailers of Marx Brothers films, including a lot of material that was seen only in the trailers and never made it into the actual films. Duck Soup,
cool.
This Saturday night, 7 o'clock, Garfield Park. Go see it.
Hey, since we're on sort of a film tear here, the Italian Film Festival is going to be taking place, and this is in conjunction with IUPUI, and the full schedule is at italianfilmfest.org, but they're showing 9 movies starting in April and running into May, and all of them are free. They're all in Italian with English subtitles, and everything from Viva l'Italia to Il Rosso, Il Blue, and some other great titles as well. So definitely worth checking out. More information, italianfilmfest.org. Last thing, Sharon?
Meow, meow.
More animal sounds.
No, more. Not really a cat impersonation, but a reminder that on April 11th and 12th at 8 o'clock at the Cabaret at the Columbia Club, the bustier-clad, vampy, sexy, and slightly deranged chanteuse drags cabaret kicking and screaming into the 21st century. That's from an actual review. If you don't know about Meow Meow, go to thecabaret.org, thecabaret.org, and learn more. Or, I mean, come on, how can you not go to it just based on her
meow,
stage?
Meow.
stage name, Meow Meow.
Well, Sharon, we've run out of time and animal sounds, but we will be back next week for more of that calendar we call.
What do we do?
You're listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and Central Indiana. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. If your arts organization has an event or activity of which you think we should be aware, please contact us at least 3 weeks in advance. You can write us at The Art of the Matter, care of WFYI, 1630 North Meridian Street, Indianapolis, Indiana, 46202. Or you can email us at artofthematter@wfyi.org. You can also hear The Art of the Matter on WFYI.org.
How can art help people dealing with the early stages of Alzheimer's disease and their families and caregivers? The answers will surprise you. Sharon Gamble was intrigued by a new docent-led tour program at the Indianapolis Museum of Art and invited the museum's Jennifer Todd, manager of docent programs, Marianne Pettingill, chair of the IMA's Docent Accessibility Committee, Linda Altmeyer, programs director at the Indianapolis chapter of the Alzheimer's Association, and Ashley Thomas, Alzheimer's Association program specialist, to talk about the tours.
So, Linda, you were telling me a little bit before we actually started our conversation about where this program started and how it got to Indianapolis. Could you tell our listeners that?
Well, we modeled the program after MoMA, which is in New York, the Museum of Modern Art, and they began this in 2005, and where early stage individuals come in to the museum and they view art, but it's different than just viewing art. It's actually engaging in the conversation of art, looking at a color and talking about it, looking at the painting. And it's the conversations between participants that is important.
And this is not just for people who are in the early stages of Alzheimer's, but for their caregivers, their families.
It is. So it's usually a person in the early stages and their care partners that come to the program. And it's also an opportunity for them to socialize outside of the home and feel comfortable with their diagnosis, because they have an opportunity to be with other couples that have the diagnosis and just feel, you know, the ability to just socialize without feeling self-conscious, right? Having a sense of community.
Yeah, because it's hard to imagine there'd be anybody listening to this conversation who hasn't been affected by having a friend, a loved one who's wrestled with Alzheimer's. And it can be a very isolating experience.
It is a very isolating experience, and I think a lot of times if you know you're losing your memory and you begin to feel self-conscious and you tend to isolate yourself, and the discussion between the care partner and the person with the disease tends to be just about the disease and what to do, and this gives people an opportunity to socialize and to engage with other people, and I think it's an opportunity to get out of the house. It's an opportunity to meet with other people. And also why viewing art or making art, because now we have the making art program at the IMA. So it's wonderful, people. And then that community starts to build, and they usually end up socializing with each other outside of the IMA and doing things because they've built their new community.
Oh, that's terrific. Hey, take us behind the scenes. Do you remember the first conversation? So someone from Alzheimer's Association Indianapolis called the IMA and said, We'd like to do this with you. What were your responses, or how did that conversation go?
I called the IMA because I wanted to do this for a few years, and then we met with the IMA, and Marianne she's a docent there. So
when they approached the IMA, I was approached because I work with the accessibility program at the IMA. And we said yes. And the question was, could we find docents to do it? Mm. And I said, absolutely, we will find docents to do that. Because my background when I was working was in healthcare. So I was very eager to do this. And we now have a group of docents who have gone through the training provided by the Alzheimer's Association. And they're very dedicated to going ahead and to doing it. And it's been about a year, I think, from when you approached us and we began the program, actually, in September, offering the tours.
And what, Jennifer, what is that, or Marion, whoever is more appropriate, what is that training like? Because that sounds like it could be a little daunting.
Yeah, we relied first on Linda and the expertise of the Alzheimer's Association to come in, and they provided a training for our interested docents. And we opened it up to IMA staff to come in as well to learn about Alzheimer's, what are the signs, what are the symptoms, and how does that change the way you interact with visitors who come to the museum? So I think everyone thought that was an extremely helpful experience. And then with the help of the Alzheimer's Association, we brought in an educator from the Museum of Modern Art, Laurel Humble, and she spent a good part of an afternoon with us, first of all talking about their program and then moving us up into the galleries to have real-time experience with providing what they refer to as a scaffolded conversation of several works of art to give docents that experience of having that conversation.
And then what we did also was the docents who were interested after they had been through this experience with Laura from MoMA, they were asked to observe each other doing the tours, and then they were to practice a tour before they went ahead and did it. And now every time a docent does a tour, what we do is we do a kind of debriefing afterwards as a way to keep ourselves on top of how we interact with the caregiver and with the Alzheimer's individuals. Also, recently, the Alzheimer's Association came back and was there for some question and answers and provided us with additional information, as we feel this is crucial for us to be able to work with the individuals and their caregivers.
So what? How big can the group be when these tours are happening?
A group of 20, and we split them into 10.
It's by dyad. So it's an Alzheimer's individual along with the caregiver.
That makes perfect sense. Mm-hmm. And can other people, like maybe if siblings are taking turns caring for a mother, it can be multiple caregivers, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Right. And this is where the partnership works so beautifully, because we rely on the Alzheimer's Association to have all of that interaction with the family. So they're making sure that it's a good fit for coming to the IMA. They are present on site to welcome the visitors when they arrive, and our docents are there ready to move up to the galleries once we get our groups formed. So we work in a great partnership together.
Sure. So what are some of the ways that the conversation changes as opposed to sort of a generic tour group? If I'm a docent, what are some of the things I need to be aware of in how I interact with the art and with my tour goers?
What we use primarily is an open-ended question approach.
Hmm.
And we will ask the individual to take a moment to just look at the image. And we may suggest some thoughts for them to think about mood, color. And we also do the tours around a theme. So a theme could be landscapes. So we will say gently, think about the trees you see. Think about what you look up in the sky and that. And then we will begin the discussion and say, well, what's going on here? What do you see?
Mm-hmm.
And then we build off of that as Jennifer said, a scaffolding approach, and the individuals feed into each other. We don't do a lot of information about the artist or the painting or the genre that it's from.
Mm-hmm.
But we will weave in, yes, this is an American artist. This is not a current one. The individual's not. We'd give some information, but more of it is for them to experience the image for themselves of what they see. Some individuals do more gesturing because they have more difficulty speaking.
Mm-hmm.
Others will be quite verbal. So we judge what kind of a group we have to how far we go with them.
Hmm. So, Ashley, I know you've worked with a lot of these individuals. Can you tell us a little bit about some of the experiences you've had? Have you had the experience of somebody's face light up because they're remembering they can still experience beauty?
Yes, we have a lot of really positive experiences. We have one family whose the grandmother lives with them, and the grandchildren now come home and ask what she's drawn for the day because she's realized that she has a passion for art. So she's very colorful. She likes to sketch. So for her, engaging in the art has really opened the door to a talent she didn't even know she had.
Wow.
So we've had that one. We have a lot of individuals who sometimes find difficulty in getting their words out. And the docents have been great in giving them that opportunity and time to get those sentences out. And so you see them light up because they are doing it. They're excited that they're getting their sentences out. People are responding to them.
And people are respecting them, too.
Yes. And so you see a lot of community within the group. And a lot of times the group is the same month to month because they've all kind of formed that bond.
Really?
Yes.
I mean, something you've just said is kind of astonishing because those grandchildren who are coming home are seeing that lady in a whole new light. You've completely changed the family dynamic.
You have changed it, and you've done it in a way that you've introduced positive things. You've introduced a way for the grandchildren to still engage with grandma and still have that relationship, even though that relationship is changing through the course of the disease. There's still something that everybody can enjoy.
Mm-hmm.
They can be involved in the art, and so can she.
What is the vision? I know we're still sort of in the infancy of this program in Indianapolis. What is the vision? What would you like to see happen as time goes on?
Well, I think one of our institutional visions from both sides of the partnership is to continue to get the word out to people that this is an amazing opportunity for families to enjoy this experience with their family member who is facing Alzheimer's. Marion, I sense that you want to share something.
I would like us eventually to do what MoMA has done, is to develop a program to go into stage two of Alzheimer's, because mm-hmm. we can see some of our patients, some of the people now coming, that they're not as remembering as much as they did when they first came, or some recognition is changing, because it's well known that the arts and music is very crucial for Alzheimer's patients. And I'd like us to be able to eventually go into that, and I'm positive we'll get the docents to do it because they're interested already.
Mm-hmm. What is the main way people are learning about this program already? Is it through your communications through the local chapter?
It's multiple. We have through our e-news, through our newsletter, we outreach to physicians throughout the state and let them know what we have for early-stage individuals in all of our programs and services. And I'd also like to add that I would say our vision is so that we have these programs, similar programs throughout the state. So we have early-stage programs that you can gauge through the arts in different areas of the state as well. But we do have different marketing techniques so that people know about this. But this kind of show helps
mm-hmm.
so that we reach the arts community.
Mm-hmm.
Because I don't feel like we do reach out to physicians, but I also think we need to reach out to the arts community and let them know of this program, because I know everyone's been touched by the disease. And wouldn't it be great if you love the arts and you now can take your mom who's been touched by the disease, or your dad, or your spouse, and you have that conversation that after you've been to the museum, you can talk about what you did. It's such a wonderful way for people to connect with each other. So I think this show helps a lot, actually.
Some number of people in earshot of this conversation are saying, I want to be one of those docents. Do you have room for more docents to receive this training?
We have actually a new docent class beginning in November of this year.
Great.
So I would invite people who are interested in becoming docents, which would be actually more of a commitment than to just lead these Meet Me at IMA tours. We really request a fairly extensive commitment of time for people who want to invest in becoming docents, but they are welcome to visit the IMA website to learn more about becoming a docent.
Terrific.
Another opportunity is with the Alzheimer's Association, where we're going to actually transition this to volunteers that have experience with dementia so they can help co-lead the tours. They will not be a docent in the IMA, but if they've had experience with dementia and they have training, then they can come in and kind of greet the people now as staff does.
The other area, when we were thinking about how we wanted to grow,
mm-hmm.
We have a docent who is very interested in doing a tour, providing an opportunity for looking at the grounds of the IMA, our 100 acres, and going out and doing some of the sculpture that we have. So we're trying to explore other ways to engage them other than being within the museum itself and looking at three images, three paintings, or a sculpture in an hour.
Sharon Gamble with the Indianapolis Museum of Arts, Jennifer Todd, Manager of Docent Programs, Marianne Pettengill, Chair of the IMA's Docent Accessibility Committee, Linda Altmeyer, Program Director of the Indianapolis Chapter of the Alzheimer's Association, and Ashley Thomas, Alzheimer's Association Program Specialist. Meet Me at the IMA Early Stage Alzheimer's Tours are offered on the second Saturday of the month from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. and on the fourth Tuesday of the month from 2 to 4 p.m. They are open to early-stage Alzheimer's guests as well as their families, friends, and caregivers, but registration is required through the Alzheimer's Association at 1-800-272-3900. Again, that's 1-800-272-3900.
Thanks for joining us today. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Buselli Wallerab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
Please listen to The Art of the Matter next week, Thursday at 8 p.m. and Saturday at 7 a.m., when I'll get a preview of the Hoosier Bard production of Arden at Feversham.
Wow. I'll find out about a new short film inspired by the song Strange Fruit.
And I'll see if the Actors Theater of Indiana really does love a piano. Plus, there'll be that arts calendar we call What'll We Do?
So please listen next weekend to The Art of the Matter here on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio.
You've been listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Central Indiana and Indianapolis. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. Today's show was edited by Melissa Davis and produced by Travis DiNicola. The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.